take seriously the word on this slide. You know, this is an introduction. This is an introduction to the Royal Psalms. But it's been a fascinating study for me and very humbling, and I hope it'd be beneficial for you this morning. I'm going to assume, some familiarity with the Psalms because you've been going through these studies, and so things like the basic types, like the praise and the hymn and thanksgiving and lament. But of course, I don't know all that you have studied, and so please feel free to ask questions, and especially at the end of the lesson. But you know, if there's something that's not clear, you know, raise your hand, and I'll try to clarify that. But let me just begin kind of with an illustration. You know, we sing a variety of hymns in our songbook, and many of them fall into some specific categories. And one in particular that's intriguing is the invitation song. I just looked at number 311 and 312. Most of church history, sermons didn't have an invitation. And so, really, the invitation song is something that's peculiar to, 19th century through early 21st century America, even throughout the world today. Most churches don't have invitations as such. And so you can just imagine a scholar, history scholar 500 years from now, looking through a list of songs and coming across invitation songs and start wondering, how are these used? So he's reading through them, studying them, and, clearly they're not something for individual devotion, day by day. You're not going to sing to yourself, "Are you coming to Jesus tonight?" This must be some sort of group setting where, it's anticipated. Maybe there's somebody who needs to respond to the message. And then also, looking at it, like number 312, "Are you coming to Jesus tonight?" Well, that assumes an evening setting, doesn't it? Well, that's kind of interesting, because in the history of the United States, the prominent service is always on the morning, isn't it? It's always Sunday. The first day of the week service is on Sunday morning. That's always been the case. But what's the history of the invitation song? Well, revivals are almost always at night. And so it's very appropriate that someone wrote a song, "Are you coming to Jesus tonight?" Because in the revival setting, and then of course for us, we have Sunday night and Wednesday night services. That's very appropriate. And then number 311, "Why not now?" That emphasizes, we're not looking for a person to respond just sometime in the evening. It's right now. The message has been spoken. We want you to make a decision right now. But then you look at verse 3, and it says, "Come to Christ, confession make." And you could just see maybe that scholar saying, what does this tell me about the theology of that group? Maybe this song belonged to a faith-only group. And so they're saying, all you got to do is make a confession, and that's all you need for salvation. Well, we'd say, wait a second. We use that song too. But when we use it, we understand that the person's going to make a confession of their faith in Christ and then be baptized into Christ. And so we just kind of read that into the song, no matter whatever the original author meant. And so I use this as an illustration just to show kind of when we look at the Psalms, some of the things that we are trying to do as we try to reconstruct the historical situation on the basis of really pretty specialized literature, these Psalms, and then also, some of the pitfalls that we can fall into. Maybe trying to assume too much or reading too much, just like that person might read too much into that phrase, "Come to Christ, confession make." So we're going to be talking about the Royal Psalms, and we have some key questions for our study this morning. Which psalms are the royal psalms? What constitutes the royal psalms? So why is it a person picked this one and not another one? How were they used? Can we say anything about how they were used? And then what is the lasting value for us today in the gospel dispensation? Now, when I first started to study this, I kind of had some preliminary frustration. I'd heard of the Royal Psalms, so when Heath called me, I was like, "Oh yeah, I can do that," and I could have told you what a few of them were. But I start to do some study, and I go and I Google it. That's always a good start. And really, when I Googled it, I found there wasn't really I wasn't getting much help with that. For example, if you Google Royal Psalms, your first hit is going to be the Holman Bible Dictionary. But really, that's the entry for the Psalms in general, and there's not really a lot of specific information about the royal psalms in that. There's not even a comprehensive list of which psalms are the royal psalms. So Wikipedia, I've always found that to be a pretty good source, but all it had was just a very short entry noting that some guy named Gunkel had picked out 10 psalms as royal psalms. And then the third one was this Grace Communion International, and it had a fairly lengthy article on royal psalms, and it noted something very important, that royal psalms don't fit into one literary type. So maybe you've talked about the thanksgiving, the lament, the praise. Well, royal psalms is not one category like that. It has some of the royal psalms are laments, some of them are praises. So that's not what distinguishes them. So that's an important point. But then it went on to illustrate using these Yahweh kingship psalms. And after I did some further study, I realized that kind of confuses things. We have these enthronement psalms, Psalm 95 through 99, and then also I think maybe 48 or something like that, that are praising God, praising Jehovah. And that really is another category. And so I bring all this up really to mention that, you know, when you're researching something new, be careful about just using one source. You know, it kind of took a while to get to some good information. And that was one of the difficulties. So I thought, okay, well, maybe I can try to research this a little bit of my own. What are some key words? A royal psalm. So, you know, maybe it's going to be something like a king or the throne. And so start doing some cross references on that. And what I found was, okay, well, it's not going to be defined exclusively by these key words. So some of the key words, well, king. What I've done here is the psalms that are regarded by everybody as royal psalms, I put those in bold and in yellow. So you can see if you do king throughout the psalms, it occurs all throughout the psalms. And in psalms that aren't necessarily royal psalms. The same thing with the word throne. The word Zion, there are songs of Zion, so that's kind of a category. But a song of Zion isn't necessarily a royal psalm. And then even the word anointed. If you want a word that maybe is pretty close to being an exclusively a unique word for a royal psalm, anointed is probably the closest one, as in the anointed one. But that also occurs in a few psalms which are not recognized as royal psalms. So how do we determine a royal psalm? And here's an interesting question. How did this even become a category? So I'm supposed to talk about royal psalms. Well, why do we have a category of royal psalms? Is there a category of royal psalms back in ancient Israel? Well, one thing that interesting that came across was that what we consider as royal psalms today, and we're thinking about Psalm 2 and 18 and 20 and 21 and 45 and 72 and 89, 101, 110, and 132 and 145, those royal psalms, they would have been included within the larger category of basically psalms authored by David. So anything authored by David is a royal psalm because David is a king. That was kind of before the 1800s, that's the way it was viewed. And then ones that had kind of exalted royal language, well, those were also messianic psalms. So there wasn't a category in the way that I'm talking about it today before the 1800s. It was just whatever's written by David, he's the king. And then anything that appears to be on a bigger scale is going to be messianic. So go ahead and turn with me to Psalm 2. This is one of course, it's the first royal psalm, and it appears early in the Psalter. And in fact, there's kind of evidence to suggest that Psalm 1 and 2 are to be connected. They go together. They're introducing the book of Psalms. Let's go ahead and just read this psalm together. You're very familiar with it, I'm sure. Why are the nations in an uproar, and the peoples devising a vain thing? The kings of the earth take their stand, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us tear their fetters apart and cast away their cords from us. He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. Then he will speak to them in his anger and terrify them in his fury, saying, but as for me, I have installed my king upon Zion, my holy mountain. I will surely tell of the decree of the Lord. He said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will surely give the nations as your inheritance, and the very ends of the earth is your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron. You shall shatter them like earthenware. Now, therefore, O kings, show discernment. Take warning, O judges of the earth. Worship the Lord with reverence and rejoice with trembling. Do homage to the Son, that he not become angry and you perish in the way. For his wrath may soon be kindled. How blessed are all who take refuge in him. Now, this psalm is not called a psalm of David. However, I believe it's quoted in the New Testament as a psalm of David. So we would say, okay, this is written by David. But it has this exalted language. Okay, did any of these kings fulfill it? Well, right away it's identified as a messianic psalm. It's quoted in the New Testament as a messianic psalm. So it would be regarded as a messianic psalm before the 1800s. But then what happened was... Well, go ahead and mention this as well. God's oath to David plays a key role in what psalms are royal psalms, and that is a recurring theme in that 2 Samuel 7, verses 12 through 16. And so that's reflected in a number of these psalms. The point I was going to get to, we have this guy, Wilhelm de Wette, who he proposed, and he's coming from the standpoint of not believing in the inspiration of the Bible. So he's going to question, in the 1800s, people were questioning the inspiration of the Bible and saying, well, this is just a human creation. So he's going to say, well, these were not written by David, first of all. And then, second of all, they should not be viewed messianically because that is a later reading. So we should look, what was the historical content of these? What was the original intent? Who was the historical king, if possible? And that's the way that it should be studied. Well, the Davidic authorship has been defended since this time, and we won't get into that. If you have some questions, we can talk about that a little bit. But his point about reading it ahistorically, and this would be probably the way we would often read it, is we just go to it and we immediately look for the messianic interpretation. Oh, well, Psalm 2, that's about Jesus. And so we kind of skip over... Well, what was the, you know, was there some original, you know, meaning, some historical situation? And I just have a few quotes for you to illustrate kind of what he was kind of dealing with. Heath mentioned the Treasury of David. That's a great resource. I've enjoyed using that from time to time. But here's a quote from Spurgeon on Psalm 2. As he's going to introduce, okay, this is going to be my commentary on Psalm 2. He says, we have in these first three verses a description of the hatred of human nature against the Christ of God. So he's just going to jump right in, messianic interpretation. Okay, well, we would agree that this is a messianic psalm, but was there a meaning in David's day as well that we should consider? Notice John Wesley. John Wesley would have lived in the generation before de Wette. This is at the top of his commentary, so this is summarizing, okay, what the contents of his commentary is going to be on Psalm 2. He says, there is nothing in this psalm which is not applicable to Christ, but some things which are not at all applicable to David. Threatenings denounced against the adversaries of Christ's kingdom, verses 1 through 6. Promises made to Christ, verses 7 through 9. Counsel given to all to submit to him, verses 10 through 12. So this is all about Jesus. And, you know, there's things in here that don't apply to David. And so he's going to just go ahead and interpret it directly messianically. Psalm 45 is a psalm about a wedding, a royal wedding. And the king is not identified. But from the description, it is this royal wedding. Notice what Spurgeon says on this psalm. He says, some here see Solomon and Pharaoh's daughter only. In interpreting this, this is only about Solomon and Pharaoh's daughter. They are short-sighted. Others see both Solomon and Christ. They are cross-eyed. Well-focused spiritual eyes see here Jesus only. Or if Solomon be present at all, he must be like those hazy shadows of passerby which cross the face of the camera and therefore are dimly traceable upon a photographic landscape. I like that. You know, just picture those cameras from the late 1800s set up on the tripod, the blanket over. And he's like, it's like that person who walks by and it takes forever for that image to be developed. So they're just going to be this blurry image. And that's what Solomon is in this psalm, if it's about Solomon. But that phrase, those with spiritual eyes see Jesus only. So from those quotes, we can see where DeVetta was coming from. You know, he's saying, okay, well, you mean these people wrote Psalms and they had no idea what the meaning was? You know, they wrote it about someone 1,000 years later, and to them, you know, it had no meaning. You know, surely it had to have some sort of meaning for them too. There had to be some use that they made of it at that time. And I think that's a valid question, even though I don't share, you know, DeVetta's overall perspective on the Bible, that it's just a human production. You know, I would say, no, it's inspired of God. So, yes, it can have that prophetic element. It can be a messianic psalm. But, yeah, I think it is appropriate to ask that question. Was there a meaning at that time as well? And we should take that seriously. All right, everyone follow me so far. Is that all pretty clear? Okay. So that kind of got the ball rolling in a certain direction and created this category of royal psalms. Okay, we shouldn't just say every psalm, you know, that David writes is a royal psalm, because he writes things that aren't necessarily royal. And then, you know, we shouldn't just have a messianic category. We should somehow combine them together. Well, really, the foundation for our current concepts is in the work of two Norwegians. And so as I started studying this, I thought, well, you know, it's too bad Heath didn't take this one on. Unfortunately, they wrote mostly in German, so it wouldn't have helped you out very, very much. But their names were Hermann Gunkel and Sigmund Mowinkel. Hermann Gunkel, he designated Psalms by category. He was studying through and he was looking for common motifs and words and ideas. And he found six major categories, and one of those was this category of royal psalms. These focused on the Israelite king. So like we said, David writes a lot of psalms, but not every psalm he writes focuses on the Israelite king. And so he's looking for those psalms. He's designating the ones that focus on the king, and he picks out 9 of them and then eventually expands it to 11. It seems that there's kind of 3 ways that they relate to the king. It's either a hymn to God, invoking a blessing on the king. It is a hymn praising the king or celebrating the king in some way, like Psalm 45, celebrating this wedding. Or it is a royal prayer. And so it's a prayer by a king that specifically would involve things that kings would do, as opposed to just your everyday person in the kingdom. So since his time, there's been debate about which one should be Psalm. So there's the list that he came up with, and then 89, the 89th is included. And so that's what I focused on in my study. Everybody agrees those are royal psalms. Now, if you start doing some study, you'll see that there's bigger lists. And so his student, Sigmund Mowinkel, identified 44 psalms as being connected to some royal occasion. And then this book, I came across this, The Essential Bible Companion to the Psalms. I really thought this would be useful for any, you know, anybody at any level of study, laid out in a great format. It just kind of goes one psalm at a time. It has a brief introduction to kind of some of the different categories of psalms. And then what you'll find is it'll say, okay, here's the theme, here's the type. So this is a Zion song. So if we turned over to, Psalm 2, it would say this is a royal psalm. I might say messianic as well. And so this is a great resource. This belongs to the library. It doesn't belong to me, but you can take a look at it. So I would recommend that. But in that one, it lists all these others as possibly royal psalms as well. Let's turn to Psalm 20 and 21. Psalm 20 and 21. Psalm 20 is a prayer, a hymn, and it's written from the perspective of the people invoking a blessing, him to God, asking for a blessing on the king, and particularly in his war efforts. And so, may the Lord answer you in the day of trouble. May the name of the God of Jacob set you securely on high. May he send you help from the sanctuary and support you from Zion. May he remember all your meal offerings and find your burnt offering acceptable. May he grant your heart's desire and fulfill all your counsel. We will sing for joy over your victory, and in the name of our God we will set up our banners. May the Lord fulfill all your petitions. Now I know that the Lord saves his anointed. He will answer him from his holy heaven with the saving strength of his right hand. Some boast in chariots and some in horses, but we will boast in the name of the Lord our God. They have bowed down and fallen, but we have risen and stood upright. Save, O Lord, may the king answer us in the day we call. And so what Gunkel came up with, let's see here. Oh, got this upside down. Okay. He identified six typical events that might be the background of these psalms. So we just read Psalm 20. He said, okay, maybe that's preparation for battle. The king is about to take his armies in battle, and maybe that type of psalm would be used to invoke God's blessing upon them before they go into battle. And then Psalm 21 seems very much connected to Psalm 20. Notice that in Psalm 20, verse 4, he says, may he grant you your heart's desire. And then we go to Psalm 21, and he says, verse 2, you have given him his heart's desire. And so here's the comment in that essential Bible companion. Under the background, it says, the psalm was probably used ceremonially prior to the king taking his armies into battle, but may also have been used upon his successful return. Okay, now why would they say that? All right, well, we don't have any, you know, specific statement that says this psalm was used before they went into battle, this psalm was used when they came back. But by looking at the language, and that this is asking for God's blessing, and then that in Psalm 21, some of it seems to be in the past tense that you have granted him the heart's desire, that this would be appropriate for that type of setting. So then Mowinkle, he kind of took things a step further and attempted to provide an elaborate setting for these psalms. And there's a word that you may come across in commentaries if you're doing some study of Old Testament stuff especially. But it's the phrase Sitzenleben. And it's a German word meaning life setting. So what was the life setting for, you know, these psalms? To go to our songbook illustration, what's the Sitzenleben? What's the life setting of an invitation song? Well, it's a revival, or it's a sermon where you've just extended the invitation and now someone gets up, leads an invitation song. So you wouldn't lead an invitation song before the Lord's Supper. That would be at the wrong time. You lead it after an invitation has been extended. So Mowinkle, he came up with this elaborate festival, the Nietorstfesten, the New Year festival. And he based that on the cultures around the Israelites, saying that, okay, in the fall of the year, at their new year, they would have this reenactment of the coronation or the enthronement of the king. And so maybe they would use these royal psalms in that situation. Now, what's happened is his reconstruction has largely been rejected. Because basically, I mean, where's the evidence? It's all speculative. We don't have anything in the Old Testament that says they have this huge festival. And we have Solomon. We're told about his coronation. You remember that, where he rides on the mule from the Gihon spring? And we're told about, Joash, that is the king when Athaliah is killed. I meant to look up his name to make sure I got one of the J names right. But in any case, we're told a little bit about his coronation, how the priest takes him and they blow the trumpet and declare him king. But there's no information about this, you know, supposed elaborate festival. But here's what it did do. It says, okay, we've got these psalms. And the assumption is they must have used them. Okay, they didn't just write them to have them sit around so that 1,000 years later we could look at them and benefit from them, although we have a great deal of benefit from them. How did they use them? Okay, well, we have all these cultures around Israel. They were using psalms in certain ways, hymns. Did they use them the same way? Did they use them differently? What evidence is there? And this is an area of study that we don't delve into a lot. I will say this. On the one hand, we are somewhat dependent upon it. In the Hebrew, there's a lot of words that only occur one time. Well, how do you determine the meaning of that word? Well, you look at the Septuagint, how it was translated into Greek, but then you also have to look at the languages that were like Hebrew. I mean, that's what the scholars are doing. That's not what I'm doing. So we're dependent in some way on that. But then, of course, what can happen is people can overreach and say, oh, well, the Israelites, they were just like the Babylonians. They did everything the same. They were just like the Egyptians. And so this is serious work that takes place. And so this whole category of royal psalms, a lot of that's happening in this stuff to say, Okay, what was the use of this Psalms, and what was the society like back then? What was the culture like? What was their theology of the king? What was the connection between Jehovah or Yahweh and the king? And so that really gets back to, okay, we're talking about the royal Psalms. What is a royal Psalm? How would we really nail it down and define what this royal Psalm is? So I came across this guy, Starbuck. I didn't get this off a cup. Okay, this isn't off Starbucks coffee cup. It just happens to be his name, Scott Starbuck. But here's his definition. The royal psalms are psalms whose concern is the institution of the Israelite kingship. Their protagonist, so the good guy, because in these psalms there's also the enemies mentioned, those who are opposing God. So the good guy is an unspecified king. Hence, he is a typological representative of the office of the institution. Okay, we're going to break that down. One thing I want to mention, he says that the protagonist is an unspecified king. Most of them are authored by David. About 7 of the 11 are authored by David. And then also, we mentioned that oath to David is a background to the royal psalms. That 2 Samuel 7, God promised him that your descendants after you, I will set up, I'll put them on the throne. Their kingdom will last forever. They will have an enduring house. And so that oath is in the background, or is even quoted extensively in many of these psalms. And so the context is going to be the context of that Davidic dynasty. But let's go ahead and break that down a little bit. The concern is the institution of the Israelite kingship. Okay, so that eliminates Davidic authorship as the determining factor. As we mentioned, David authored, I can't remember now the number, seemed like it was, 70-something are ascribed to him. Okay, just because a psalm says a psalm of David doesn't make it a royal psalm. It has to be concerning the kingship, the Israelite kingship, in order for it to be a royal psalm. We mentioned that before, Songs of Zion. Zion, of course, is very much connected in many ways to the monarchy, because that's where they ruled from. However, Zion was viewed as the place where God put his name. It's the holy city. So those songs of Zion can be celebrating the holy city without really referencing the king. So just because something is a song of Zion, it has to concern the institution of the Israelite kingship. Okay, so then he also said the unspecified king is the protagonist. And so that also distinguishes it from those enthronement psalms that I mentioned earlier, Psalms 95 to 99, which celebrate Yahweh, celebrate Jehovah, not the human king. And so those psalms, they begin, "The Lord reigns." Okay, "The Lord reigns." Well, that's celebrating God and his kingship. Now, as I think about that, if God is the one who reigns all over the creation, and he's picked David to be the human king, then these psalms that celebrate God's sovereignty, they are going to bring legitimacy to the Davidic dynasty. So there is a connection between God's reigning and then the David, King David and his dynasty. But those psalms, they really celebrate God's reign, not a human king. But then, because they're unspecified, that limits the ability to identify that historical setting. So that's what so many of the scholars want to do. Okay, what king is in view? What is the specific? You know, was there a battle that took place? What was the event where this psalm would be used? But then also what Starbuck points out is that this is a significant difference compared to the other royal hymns in the ancient Near East. And so, so often we hear people come along and they make some point like, oh, well, we've got the creation story in Genesis and there's these creation stories in other literature. The Jews just got their creation story from other people and, you know, therefore the creation story is just a myth. Or the flood. Well, all these places, they had flood stories, and so the Jews, they just got their flood stories from, Babylon or whatever, and so it's all just a myth. And so likewise, in these studies, people come along and say, oh, well, you know, these other cultures, they had royal psalms. The Jews, they just got their royal psalms from them. And in trying to define the royal psalms by these other cultures. Well, what often happens is there are surface level similarities between these things. So there's some surface level similarity between the creation story over here and the story in Genesis. But then when you dig deeper, if you're going to compare those things, you have to fairly evaluate whatever differences you find too. And so, and maybe you've studied those things in the past as far as like the creation story, is that there are significant differences between Genesis 1 and the way it presents creation and talks about God and these, you know, myths from other cultures. And so that's what this scholar has pointed out about these royal psalms, is that in all these other cultures, the king wants everybody to know who he is. So within the hymn, he names himself because he wants to take credit. You know, if you're invoking a blessing on the king, he wants to make sure God gets the right person. So his name is all throughout that hymn. But we turn to these royal hymns, and there is the superscription at the top, a Psalm of David. But within the hymn itself, there's no one mentioned. And so it's an unspecified human king. And so I think that really leads to this next point, that this royal psalm and the king, he becomes a typological representative of the office of the institution. And so because all these other royal hymns in the ancient world specifically mention the king over and over again, this couldn't be accidental. It's not an accident that in, you know, almost basically every one of these psalms, the exception is 144, and that is actually a quotation from a psalm that's found in 1 Samuel, I believe. But all the others, within the hymn, there's no mention of who the king is. And so that leaves this door open and creates this space for messianic interpretation. That what is being presented here is this ideal king. Yes, it has some sort of historical use. You know, maybe it is used in a coronation ceremony. So maybe when Solomon is enthroned, maybe they read Psalm 2. Okay, and so that's a part of that ceremony. There's no way to know. That's complete speculation. All we know is that in other cultures, they would have some sort of ceremony in which the king would be enthroned and they would read some hymns and stuff. We know that there was an enthronement of Solomon, that he rode on the mule and that the people proclaimed, "Long live the king." Maybe they read Psalm 2. However, what we find out from comparing with these other cultures is that each king would actually write his own psalm or have someone write it. He wouldn't just reuse the psalms of previous kings. He would have one created for himself. So to go back to Mowinkle's idea that, okay, well, they just had this festival every year, and they would just reuse these psalms over and over again, well, there just really is no evidence for that. The evidence points to each king specifically creating psalms, and so that really goes back to these are psalms written by David. He wrote them with a specific thing in mind, but then the way that they were written leaves this room for this typological representative that there is this ideal king. And so then when we look at the ideal king, what we see is that the Jewish kings all fail to reach that ideal. One thing that's is interesting, if you think about how is the kingship represented in most Old Testament literature, in most parts of the Old Testament. How is the kingship represented? You know, is it a good thing or a bad thing? Well, you know, we have just a couple of laws in Deuteronomy that are, you know, kind of trying to limit the damage kings can do. You know, don't let them get a bunch of horses. Don't let them get a bunch of wives. Okay, so that's trying to protect the people from the king. You remember when Saul is anointed king, Samuel gives two really long speeches about all the trouble that the king is going to cause. And then you go through the history of 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles, and basically every king is bad. Even the good ones do some bad things. And so there's a pretty kind of a negative view of kingship in a lot of the Old Testament literature. But you get to the Psalms, and in the Psalms, it's almost unanimously positive. you know, look at this king. He's the anointed of God, and God is going to use him to do all these great things, and he's going to bring the nations into submission, and he's going to have this universal reign. And so they're celebrating the role of the king and what he can accomplish. And so since history confirms the failure of most kings, then that would lead us to this idea that, yes, this is a typological representation of the office. And we're looking for some greater fulfillment. And, of course, if we go back to 2 Samuel chapter 7, to that promise of God to David, that seems embedded in that as well. I'm going to put your descendants on the throne. It will endure forever. But then he says, if he commits iniquity, I will chastise him. So God anticipates that these descendants of David could sin. And if they do, he'll punish him. But then the end result is going to be this covenant's going to last forever. And so we find those human kings failing, God punishing them. But the Jewish people were looking forward to that messianic application. Okay, another aspect of this as well, that's really fascinating. So we're talking about the royal psalms, this category. So a question I never really thought to ask so much, how did the royal psalms get into the psalms? Okay, 7 of the 11 are ascribed to David, so they're written about 1000 B.C., but when's the book of Psalms put together? Why did these psalms make it in and maybe not some others? Well, we look at Psalm 45. That is that royal wedding psalm. And it seems to, it's a part of a group of psalms that are the songs of the sons of Korah. So it seems like it maybe makes it in because it's a group. It's with this other category. Psalm 132 is part of the Song of Ascent. I think it's from Psalm 120 to 134 is the Song of Ascent. So it's a part of that group, and it makes it in. Psalm 2 and 89 seem to be clearly related to the beginning and end of books 1 and 2. They really seem to frame that collection. And as I mentioned, there seems to be some evidence that Psalm 2 was purposely put at the beginning of the Psalms to help define this collection. And so this is an intriguing point, and it's speculative, but there doesn't seem to be any evidence that there was a collection of royal psalms. So, you know, here's this collection of royal psalms, so now we're going to put these in because they're really scattered throughout the book of Psalms. They seem to individually kind of make it into the psalms. You know, and so is it possible that that as the psalms are being collected, because of this idea of this typological, that they understood this oath to David. And they saw that, okay, here's a promise to a king. And yes, maybe this was used in a coronation ceremony, or maybe this psalm was used before they went out to battle or something like that. But they realized, hey, this has serious implications. This has messianic implications. And so by inspiration, these are collected into the psalms because of their significance, of that hope that someone is going to finally fulfill these desires that we have and these promises that we have that God has made. Go over to Psalm 89. Go over to Psalm 89. This is, as I mentioned, Psalm 2 is at the beginning of the book of Psalms, and it seems like very purposely put there. Psalm 89 comes at the end of book 3. I think I said book 2 earlier, book 3. And it's interesting that this would be the end of a book, a collection. The first two-thirds of the psalm quote extensively and refer to this oath to David, that God has made this covenant. Verse 3, I have sworn to David my servant, I will establish your seed forever. And it goes on to talk about what God's role for David was going to be and what the ideal was, that, you know, they were going to reign in righteousness and justice and you know, this kind of this perfect rule, and that God would, you know, crush their enemies beneath them and all of those things. So for the first, you know, 37 verses, it just quotes this oath and about what the intention was. Verses 30 through 37 is kind of a transition because it mentions that part of the promise. If his sons forsake my law, then I will punish them. So it's kind of anticipating. Okay, that was part of the promise too. If these human kings, if they fail, then yes, they will be punished. But still, we have this promise. Verse 37, it will be established forever. Okay, now look at verse 38. But you have cast off and rejected. You have been full of wrath and against your anointed. You have spurned the covenant of your servant. You have profaned his crown in the dust. You have broken down all his walls. And it goes on to say, God, you've rejected us. Here you had this promise, and you said it was going to last forever, but now we're feeling rejected. How long, O Lord, verse 46, will you hide yourself forever? And so there clearly was this intense feeling of, there's this promise, we know it's there, but it doesn't seem to be quite working out. You know, wait a second, when is this really going to be fulfilled? And so, of course, now we see Jesus. And in studying this, you know, the resurrection gives the stamp of approval to view these things, I think, prophetically and typologically, that Jesus, being of the lineage of David and making these claims, okay, well, anybody can make a claim, but then he resurrects from the dead. And so, as Paul says in Romans chapter 1, that he was born of the seed of David according to the flesh, but then according to power, he was raised according to the power of the Spirit of holiness. And so that vindicates and it validates that, yes, now we can go back and we can look at these Psalms. And yes, these royal Psalms written for some occasion, written about the Israelite kingship, but they anticipate something so much greater. And so that's why, Psalm 2 and Psalm 110. Psalm 110 is the most quoted psalm, and I guess the most quoted passage in the New Testament. Jesus refers to it several times. The Lord says to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. It validates that interpretation to say, yes, this is about the Messiah. There was going to be this greater fulfillment that would take place. And so it has its beginning with David, and that there was a promise to David, and God promised him that this dynasty and that Solomon would rule on his throne, and then the descendants after him, the kings of Judah, and yet they didn't quite fulfill the language of these Psalms. And so we see Jesus in his first coming. He fulfills some of it in his first coming, but there's going to be even a greater fulfillment in his second coming. But I'll end really on this note, looking at Psalm 110. So often we think about the application to Jesus and he being the Messiah, he being the anointed one. And as we mentioned, that's one of the key words in many of these Psalms, the anointed one, which is related to that word Messiah. But we think about Jesus. But then we realize we're his kingdom. And so these Psalms that are royal Psalms that talk about all the things the king is going to do, so many of them have great application to us who are his people. And so as I'm reading through Psalm 110, you know, we so often that the verse that gets quoted in the New Testament is verse 1, and then dropping down to verse 4 about him being after the order of Melchizedek. So we know the Hebrew writer makes a big deal out of that. But, you know, as we read through this psalm, the Lord says to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. The Lord will stretch forth your strong scepter from Zion, saying, rule in the midst of your enemies. Your people will volunteer freely in the day of your power. In holy array from the womb of the dawn, your youth are to you as the dew. If verse 1 is talking about Jesus, who's verse 3 talking about? You know, aren't we his people? He says that this anointed one, your people will volunteer freely in the day of your strength, in the day of your power. Jesus has gone forth and is conquering. And if we are his people, then we're participating in that victory. We're to be voluntarily freely knowing that the power has been given to Christ. And so these enemies that we have out there, we have the power to defeat them. Because the power is not in us, it's in our Messiah. It's in the Lord's anointed. And so we can go back to these royal Psalms and see how they exalt Christ and His position as the Messiah, but then we realize we're a part of that kingdom. We're participating in that, and so these blessings flow to us as well. Well, I hope these comments have been beneficial to you. There's just so much material, and as we mentioned at the beginning of the lesson, these psalms, they cover a variety of types of material, like Psalm 89, that lament, and then praises. We read Psalm 20, where it's asking for God to bless the king. And then these ones that are very clearly forward-thinking, Psalm 2 and Psalm 110. So